Sortocracy is compassion is a declaration of independence from those who would render it impractical for consenting adults to form their own government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Henrik. This is Red Eyes Radio. Thank you for tuning in. It's good to be back with you again. You might have noticed that we took a few days off last week, just in case you're wondering what happened to us. No, the globalists didn't get to us. We simply needed to enjoy the summer heat a bit and recharge the batteries. We rarely do take breaks, which makes it so much more important to take some breaks to disconnect for a bit, reflect, regroup, and return with a more sharp vision. RedEyes.tv is our website. If you want to become a member and see our live shows, listen to the full radio show, please go to RedEyesMembers.com. Our show today is with James Bowery, who's going to share with us some of his ideas for the need of a new spiritual system. I guess you could say religion or a new church, if you prefer those terms. It might sound like the creation of a wacky church or some cult or something, but that's not at all what James is going to discuss here today. He's going to share some pretty interesting ideas based on his scientific work, his own spiritual experiences, and also his work on what he calls sortocracy. We'll talk more about that later in detail. But also an understanding of the fact that a system of governance needs to have a basis in nature, and that it's only a system that appreciates individual perception of morals that is going to be able to achieve this, I guess, to some significant degree. We'll let him explain that in more detail. He's going to outline most of his ideas in the first hour, and then we'll fire off some more questions in the second hour to try to understand a bit better what some of his proposals are. Also, James suggested that we publish this interview on July 4th, as this is the Independence Day of the Americans, so it's a symbolic value to his declaration at this date, if you will. Stay tuned. Hope you enjoy. All right. Welcome, James Bowery. Glad to have you with us. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Now, you did a show with Lana on 314 almost 2 years ago. Very interesting show that I highly recommend that our audience to check out and listen to. You're a pioneer in IT. You're very well-versed in many different scientific fields. You're involved in many different projects. Some that I have difficulty wrapping my head around, to be honest. You're just an all-around brilliant guy, you know. But today, James, we're going to talk a bit more about something which is obviously more personal to you, something that you've become more and more concerned and invested in over time. It's regarding the need for a religion, a new church of sorts. Tell us first what kind of lie at the foundation of this idea of and why you wanted to talk about this today.
Well, what precipitated it was a confluence of events, not just things like Brexit and other things like that, which obviously play into it, but also there was an announcement of a five-year-old girl that was sexually abused by refugees in Twin Falls, Idaho, I believe. And that came about at the same time. Well, I should say, first of all, that one of the things that has been happening is religions are increasingly involved with refugee resettlement into the United States. And when they do this, they can do so in one of two modes. One of the modes they can do is there's a refugee in their community that's put there by, say, a government agency or some NGO. And what they do is they try to make sure that the community and the refugee get along. However, there might be some conflicts, there might be problems, but they try to intervene and deal with it. Something else they can do is they can actively participate in the resettlement of refugees into communities that may or may not welcome those refugees. Now, you get something happening like this sexual abuse of a five-year-old by refugees. If there are religious organizations that are involved, and virtually all of the Protestant, all the Christian religions are now involved in this kind of resettlement, what kind of responsibility do they have to the communities? And what kind of religion are they really if they're doing this to communities against their will? This kind of subversion of religion by this kind of supremacist global agenda that's damaging people is so pervasive, and it's gotten to the point where there are a lot of people with genuine religious needs that don't have anywhere to go, because they're the only place they can go are these places where they're running around doing these kinds of, morally vain, reckless, irresponsible kinds of actions for no higher purpose than to appear good in the sight of social scientists or politicians. And it's a travesty of religion for this to be going on. And anybody who's not simply, a lot of people, when they're interested in a religion, they're really just going for a community. They're going there, they don't really have any strong beliefs. They just want to, have some place to go to sort of share good feelings with people on Sunday. To some extent, it could be deeper than that, but they're not really looking at things like this in the terms that they really need to be looking at them. But there are people who are more serious about things, and I'm one of them. And that's why I can't go to church. I have to get some background. I was raised in a fundamentalist church, and I stopped going to church at my teenage years because of the fact that I told my parents that I had reached the age of accountability and I should have, according to almost all Protestant religions, my own moral agency. This is one of the foundations of Protestantism, is that the individual conscience is sacred. It is a gift from God, a gift from the Creator, and that to violate that through theocracy, for example, dictating how one is supposed to live one's life, and the moral principles, etc., is a violation of creation. And my parents, having integrity, and being loving parents, they relented and let me go ahead and pursue my path. After this happened, after I stopped going to church, I had an experience that really changed and directed my life. It was after I had been out of contact with people for about 2 weeks due to an illness, and I was coming back into some health, but a teenager being isolated for a long period of time like that, it's a significant event for them. It was for me, at least, and I think it is for many teenagers. And what I started experiencing was the degree to which I had become addicted or over-influenced by other people, and I started realizing that there was an absence in my life of something, and I didn't really understand what. But it very, very profoundly disturbed me, and I asked for help. And at the moment that I asked for help, I experienced what I can almost describe as explosive joy, and a sense of being lifted and actually seeing a vision. And I have to tell people, I'm not saying this like, Joseph Smith, I'm bringing you my message or anything like that. Right. I'm trying to do this so you understand the power of this experience and that it did change my life. And I am sincere about this. And I'll finish it off. It didn't last a long time. One of the things that actually perhaps the thing that terminated it was one of the people that I saw in this vision was a man. He was kind of a hippie kind of guy, but he was one of those, guys, kind of a cynic, bitter kind of character. And here I was experiencing this expansive joy, and there was this intelligence about it too that I was experiencing. And it was, clearly, the help was coming from somewhere. And I'm sure that Christians would say it was Jesus. Others would say, or one of the bodhisattvas or something, but it was real. And when I saw this man, the disconnect between my state and the state of bitterness and cynicism brought me down. And it didn't bring me down like, oh, I'm getting brought down by this guy. It's more like I felt compassion for him. And that's what brought me back. And It wasn't until years later that I realized he was Jewish. I spent my life, I'm 62 years old now, that was about age 16, 17, I can't remember, I think 16, making sense out of this. I could not go to a church because for me to go to a church and subject my experience to their narrative would have been like a true blasphemy.
Right, yeah.
And I couldn't, so I couldn't be part of a congregation, and I couldn't go start preaching to people because I hadn't made sense out of it myself. But I knew one thing. I knew that this contained within it the meaning of life, at least for me. And so I set about doing the best that I could, trying to make sense out of it, with the feelings about that sort of guiding me. Now, again, I'm trying to say this. This is the first time I've spoken about this publicly. I haven't spoken about this to you know, family and friends, you know, a lover now and then, here and there. But it's the kind of thing where I'm saying it publicly now because of the fact that this is not a cynical attempt to set up a religion with me as Pope or anything like that. I'm grappling with something that made me profoundly dissatisfied with the world that is as it is. And that dissatisfaction with the world as it is and the hunger to try to connect this experience to the world as it is, led me on a search. And don't have all the answers now, but I've put a lot of the pieces together, and I think I've got a pretty good idea of what needs to be done in a general outline. And I need help. I need help from people to complete this. And I think that they'll, when I start talking about it, they'll understand it, because some of this is really familiar to people. Just the idea that we as individuals are somehow miracles, and our will is miraculous. Our moral agency is an aspect of being human. Humans want to be right as much as they want sex and other things. You know, that's one of the things that distinguishes humans from other sexual species is our moral sense, our sixth sense, if you will, a sense of being able to see and love integrity in ourselves and in others. And when we see integrity in another, we're seeing it in an individual. An individual is standing before us as another God. We are a miracle. And they are miracles. We are obviously, you know, the direct experience of the miraculous. And the respect of this moral agency in ourselves and in others is what truly ennobles us. And when we do things like come into a community with objectionable cultures, even though one might respect the individuals of those cultures as fellow gods, that does not mean that they have the same moral sensibility that we do. In fact, it's important that they don't have the same moral sensibility that we do in order for there to be genuine creation. This is one of the things about the moral, the individual moral agency, it's essential to creation. And when you mix things together like this and call it diversity, it's the exact opposite. It's destroying diversity. It's making it impossible for there to be a flowering diversity. And sortocracy, which I have been promoting as sort of a secularized expression of this religious impulse, is these what I call the sorting proponents of social theories and the governments that test them. Anybody who's really rational understands now that social theory being imposed at the state level by the federal government has produced a de facto theocracy. We don't have religious freedom now. We cannot express what our true beliefs. If we violate what political correctness, then that is not allowed. There were damaged, were practically exterminated because of the fact that you can do things like take somebody like myself. I've for years been open about my opinions about Jews and about races and things of that nature. And I've been at an echelon of technology, the technology profession, where, you know, this has done me damage. And,
yeah, of course.
You know, it may very well be the reason that I have not been able to raise my children, So this is the kind of thing where you can actually get rid of bloodlines. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I personally resent that, of course, but of course, when I look around at what's happening to the society at large, the loss of my bloodline is nothing.
Yeah. It's happening everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, when I was down at the Easter gathering that I met you and Lana at, and I brought some chicks down, and there was a girl there who tried to help, and she killed one of the batch of chicks.
Very sad.
Yeah. Lana was very, very upset about that.
Yeah.
Night.
Yeah.
And she said, "Well, that sounds like a bad omen." I said, "You know, Lana, you know, we live in a dysgenic culture." And I don't think she really understood why I was saying. I just see, you know, massive, massive destruction of humanity and God's creation going on.
Yeah.
And that destruction creates a sense of urgency in me. It also creates a sense of my own, you know, how unimportant I am, you know, when it comes right down to it. But it also creates in me a sense of I really want to do something and maybe, you know, be important in some way that can help address this. And so that was one of my primary impetuses for sort of talking about Certocracy and trying to bring into a non-religious sort of context the ideas of the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution's protection of state powers, where you could have a diversity of social policies in the states. Of course, the Declaration of Independence and any kind of independence of political thought and political organization creates more diversity and greater freedom for people to choose the kind of society in which they want to live and contribute and raise their children. So this is sort of the broad outline of where I started and where I have come and why I'm at this point committing the outrageous act of starting a religion.
Right.
And I know that there are going to be people that are cynical about this kind of thing, but, you know, like I said, I'm trying to help them too.
Right. So it's a, I mean, obviously a number of things here that are very interesting that we can discuss in more detail. First off, I think you're absolutely right when you mentioned that religions overall have obviously been created and transformed and changed, reformed by people who know that experiences that you were talking about are real, right? They have hijacked these real spiritual experiences in some cases for their own purposes. As you said, today the Christian church is helping to break up our communities, displacing our own people, leading to direct harm of our own children. So this is something that has to be addressed, and it also have to be replaced in some way, which is a terribly difficult thing to do, considering how long many of these established religions have been going now, right?
In particular, people need communities and need religious communities, and they already have them, but they're being taken over from the top by these influences that are profoundly, I see them as profoundly evil,
right?
And I can't contribute my energy or presence to them
right.
because of that. So I you know, in a way, I'm creating this religion for me, but also for the people who are like me, you know, and I'm sure that there are many, many people who are like, you know, I mean, that I shouldn't say other people like me. People need a community, but there are people who are really serious about the meaning of life and trying to make sense of this whole thing. And in making room for a variety of different ways of organizing communities, different moral systems, and the like. Although it's it's been done before by Martin Luther and the founder of the American Baptist congregation and the Quakers. You know, they've all lost their way. They're all starting to impose these social theories on the communities in which they live. And it's been going on for some time. During the frontier days, after the formation of the United States, people could always escape to the frontier and form communities isolated from those who were incompatible with them. The LDS is a prime example out in Utah. But eventually, you know, things caught up with them, and they were sort of domesticated, and now they're resettling refugees and people's communities, and possibly resulting in girls being raped. And the LDS, I have family members in the LDS. I for those who want to be Christians, I can't recommend a religion more highly than the LDS, primarily because of the fact that in their teachings, Joseph Smith's version of Genesis and talking about the fall of Lucifer to become Satan is widely regarded, at least in the LDS, as being the plan that Lucifer had to remove from man his moral agency, to make him more of an automaton so that he could not commit sin. And this is exactly the kind of thing that political correctness does to us. And it's exactly the kind of thing that the LDS isn't, when they're resettling refugees and communities, they're not directly doing that, but they're indirectly forcing upon people an altruism they may not have chosen. They are now, that community is now forced to engage these refugees in a way that may disrupt whatever kind of direction of creation they had been, this community had been pursuing before, and that violates their moral agency. So even the LDS, the best of the Judeo-Christian religions, in my opinion, has fallen now.
Right.
Yeah. It's sad. It's really sad. That's one of the things that also has precipitated my decision. Another thing is that my wife suffers from Huntington's disease. This is a personal thing. All this is personal, but it's more of an individual thing. And because of the fact that she's been recently institutionalized, there are two things that are going on. One thing is she's facing death, and she needs a congregation, and I need one for her, but I cannot attend one of these churches with her out of my personal integrity.
Is it this her desire? Has she expressed this desire?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
She has. And that saddens me greatly. Another thing is that because I'm no longer a caregiver, I've been her caregiver for 13 years, and it's progressively gotten to the point where I can no longer play that role. Coming out of that role, I am now in a position where I'm going to be pursuing some things that I've been developing while her caregiver. I had time, being required to stay at home with her, to pursue a lot of different interests and find out which things I was wanted to do professionally with the rest of my life. And one of these things is a green revolution that will make Norman Borlaug's look like kindergarten. Quite seriously, this is not a speculative technology. It's the kind of thing where if somebody had money, they could reduce the agricultural print of civilization by a factor of 10, restore the rainforests. If you care about CO2, you get high quality protein, omega-3 fatty acids, brain food, etc. And it's ready to go. And the problem is that the capital structures and capitalism in the West is so sick, primarily because of the way in which it's been coddled. And I can talk about that, but that the places that are looking at financing this are places in the tropics, and part of that is because of the fact that solar energy is more available there, and you want to grow this in places where you have the highest solar energy because you have a certain amount of capital outlay per area, and so you want to make sure you've got the highest solar concentration. The problem is some of these places aren't so stable, And in fact, most of them aren't so stable. In fact, one of the three places that I was seriously looking at possibly relocating to, at least on a temporary basis, was in Bangladesh, the very place that was just yesterday, I believe, attacked, and the foreigners were all killed.
Right. Damn. Yeah. That's right.
In fact, I was being directed there as opposed to some other places because of the fact that it was safe, supposedly.
Mm.
And it's not.
Yeah.
but this is the kind of thing I have to do this because I cannot turn my back on this on the years of research that I did into finding where the next green revolution was going to be. And I'm going to be taking risks with my life to do this if I have the opportunity to do it. I mean, you know, if somebody comes along with the financing and et cetera, and makes it possible for me to not have to do that, I would gladly not risk my life and while seeing this happen. But then it's important that this happen, not just because of the fact that the world needs food. The world needs food in a way that does not take up so much of nature. And, you know, Norman Borlaug's Green Revolution, he managed to come up with some wheat that was able to double the production of the existing arable land, but he did not reduce the arable land that's required to support civilization. And there was additional population. And of course, if you do another Green Revolution, that's even greater. There's a possibility of even more reproduction, creating more population. But we have seen something called the demographic transition. And the demographic transition tends to occur once people are outside of something called the Malthusian trap. It's not something that's going to be a permanent solution to this. You can't have a permanent solution to the conflict between exponentiation and limited dimensions in which you live. I mean, you know, two dimensions is bad enough. I mean, even you go three dimensions into space, exponentials, if people know anything about them, they're infinite dimensions. I mean, every, you know, you have a dimensionality required that's proportional to the number of dimensions. And so you have a fundamental conflict no matter what you do with exponentiation, with life reproducing. But having said that, there is something that we can do to ameliorate the urgent problems we're facing. For example, the influx of people into Europe is being driven in large measure by things like the failure of the demographic transition in Africa and other places. There is a lot of political instability resulting from the food shortages, even though people will say that it's no food shortage, it's a distribution problem. It is both. And this particular technology makes it possible to have very decentralized, high-grade food production. So, it's the kind of thing that could really bring population pressure off of Europe in terms of the refugees and help advance the demographic transition in some of these nations, including in Africa, where you've got guys like the Gates Foundation that are going around trying to get this to happen.
But right. They're failing, obviously, because it's just growing and growing, right?
It's worse than that. I'm gonna disclose something that happened. It sounds like a digression, but it's important to understand.
Sure, yeah.
In 87, I was working as a consultant down in La Jolla with Science Applications International Corporation, and I had been doing things with radiation stack monitoring and for nuclear plants and some of the things. Anyway, in the Persian Gulf, there was a crisis where the Reagan administration had put all these billions of dollars into military buildup, Star Wars, et cetera. But they had forgotten a few real basics, okay? And there was I can't go into it because it was a secret project, but I can mention things in general. There was a potential cutoff in the oil supply to the West that was imminent. And this resulted in a project being initiated. I was one of about 10 to 12 people called in by SAIC to try to come up with a technical fix very rapidly and get it deployed. The technology, I won't talk about the details of that either, obviously, but one of the things that had to be done was some programming, which is why I was called in. And I spent some time, without asking permission from any of the the guys who were in authority, developing a tool that overcame some of the problems in programming this very advanced prototype equipment. If people have worked with systems integration, they know if you have new hardware and you're trying to program it, there are all kinds of things you have to do to build, to create a tool chain to program that. Yeah. Well, there was very little for this. It was very complicated, very sophisticated. And so I just went off and I started building a tool chain. I got things so that you could operate at a much higher level of abstraction. One of the manager directly over me ended up using this quite a bit. And when I was debriefed prior to the full deployment of the system, he said, "You know, Jim, if I'd known you were writing that, I would have stopped you because it wasn't directly on task, right? Mm-hmm. But it saved the project." This guy ended up in control of the Gates Foundation nutrition project. And I called him when I discovered this technology. I mean, it was a coincidence. I had no idea. So he knew that I was no technical slouch. Okay.
Right.
And I described to him the basic arithmetic. And so Gates keeps on talking about, you know, the Borlaug. You know, he gives a speech about Norman Borlaug and not Des Moines. And, you know, here's this technology and it's been proven and it, you know, got shut down by the financial crisis of, 2008, 2009. Needs to be refinanced to get the factories up. Here's how, can basically feed everybody an American level of protein and omega-3 for brains and, this kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah.
He said, "Well, Jim, that's not on strategy for this foundation."
Right.
And, you know, I had CC'd this, by the way, to Ray Ozzie, who I had gone to college with. And Ray was the guy that Bill Gates called in to take over Gates' position at Microsoft. This mm-hmm. is after he had done that. And couldn't get any interest out of anybody.
Hmm.
This is crazy, right? I mean, unless they had gone off and gotten some consultants and said, "Okay, well, here's why these numbers are bad," right? But it seems like they would have come back to me and said, "Well, here's why you're wrong, Jim."
Right.
Yeah. But no, nobody bothered.
But they looked at it in detail. They understood what it was and the benefits.
Nobody even bothered to look
right.
at it.
Right. Okay.
I came in and said, there's this thing, and I described in broad outline. It gets the capital cost per area down, so you don't have capital service problems, and you can.
Yeah.
Et cetera. You do the basic spreadsheet that any undergrad in business school can do, doing net present value calculations, et cetera, et cetera. And it wins. It beats soybeans. You can take out virtually the base of the agricultural food chain, therefore the base of civilization, because civilization is founded on agriculture.
Sure.
And reduce the footprint, so you can restore the rainforest and all the rest of the stuff. Anyway, what I'm trying to get at is that, this is important, okay? And I can't just turn my back on it. And it looks like, there may be coming along at any moment, some major players, but that's the kind of thing where you can, wait and wait and wait for years, and here's another guy. I may have to take some risks with my life in these places.
Right, to get it out there and whatnot. There's a very interesting detail, though, about the Gates Foundation. We've been talking with various guests for years about how they primarily have been pushing GMOs as a solution to all of this problem. And in some regards, they accuse Bill Gates of being behind, eugenics, that one of the speeches he did, he wanted to lower the population rate, etc. But it's the opposite, actually. It's going in the opposite direction in terms of the work that they're doing.
Yeah, it is kind of ironic. This technology is such that it is actually does not benefit from genetic engineering. It's the kind of thing where, if you pursue an algae technology that's open pond, for example, then you start getting into things where you say, okay, let's genetically engineer it to be able to compete with the local species of algae, for example. Well, once you do that, then you're talking about potentially creating a species that can spread outside.
Of course.
And compete.
Yep. It's already a huge problem with GMOs that is not addressed, by the way. Right. Yeah. Anyway.
So, but you know, if you do something where you're basically enclosing it and creating a cloistered environment, you're coddling it and isolating it from the general environment. Just basically all you're doing is using CO2 and sun and right. some nutrient inputs. Okay. It's not having to compete with anything else. And therefore it can be a weak strain. And in fact, it will tend to be a weak strain because it's specifically optimized for this particular kind of environment. It gets outside of the environment, it's not going to make it, okay? And in fact, you know, there have been none of the tests have been done with anything other than like chlorella and, you know, the standard natural species. And they all yield reproducible results that solve the food problem, period.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And solve the agricultural food, you know, civilization's footprint problem, period. Okay. And all you have to do is sit down and do the arithmetic, and these idiots will not do the arithmetic. I'm sorry, I have to call them idiots.
Oh, that's fine by me. Yeah, fine by me.
Okay. And I think part of the reason they won't do the arithmetic is because of the fact that a lot of these, when it gets into, you know, these things like environment and, you know, global impact, and what you're really dealing with is a social milieu where people are engaging in a lot of social posturing about just like in religion.
Yep.
Okay. Just, you know, my church is resettling more, you know, brown people than your church. And so I'm not a racist.
Right. It's true.
And you know, they're absolutely unconcerned about the consequences. I mean, I shouldn't say they're absolutely, they aren't seriously concerned about the consequences.
No.
So, now in terms of, you know, Bill Gates being, you know, I've got my complaints about Bill Gates that go back having to do with computers. And so insofar as the Gates Foundation and GMOs and things like that, I have not really looked into it. And I'm not really even that interested because there's a solution to all this. Okay. I mean, it's like, I'm not really that concerned about global warming from a CO2 standpoint, because there's a solution, whether it's a problem or not.
Right.
You know, so it doesn't really interest me.
Yeah.
But the main thing is to get it to happen, and so it becomes makes these issues moot. So I'm sorry for the rather long digression about this thing, but this is important too. Okay. And part of the reason that it's important, the reason it plays in, is because an aspect of the religious aspect of the individual gets into a difference between humans and other sexual species that has to do with the way we form groups. We have a tendency to form these groups. In fact, E.O. Wilson, the naturalist who came up with sociobiology, has talked about humanity being a eusocial species, or at least a partially eusocial species, like the ants and the termites, etc. All other species going back 600 million years, all sexually reproducing species, where there's been a lot of sexual selection going on, things that where the opposite sex, you appeal to the opposite sex through displays, through beauty, through a demonstration of genetic equality, all these things that caused the Cambrian explosion of life.
Right.
And since then, all this marvelous creation, all these species did so on the basis of individual perception of value in the opposite sex first. And when they're operating as sexual species, it's looking at the opposite sex and having perception. And for humans, when we form things like civilization, we start to select on different characters, like the ability to argue well in a court of law or politics, or being able to start a religion. Cuckold the parishioners, right?
Yeah.
And it's very serious. In fact, you know, one of the things that had to happen in Northern Europe, I mean, if you look at the adoption of Christianity in Iceland, the very same all thing, or maybe it was the next all thing, around year 1000 or so, that they adopted Christianity, they outlawed the natural dual, Homgang.
Yes.
And the reason that they did that, I'm convinced from just my own perception of how this works, is imagine getting some guy gets up in front of a bunch of people and starts telling them stories, you know, about this miraculous guy that's not around and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, therefore, you know, except, you know, that you should do this and blah, blah, blah. Right. Well, if some man in the community sees this guy doing this and he is endangering his family or the entire community by spreading something that's going to subvert something about the way they live so they can survive in the climate in which they live, the natural instinct is to protect. Now, he might stand up and say, you know, you're not supposed to say that or do that or whatever. He might, if it goes on long enough, to say, okay, well, you and I will go to the island and one of us will come back at most.
Right.
For that.
Yeah.
Because we can't have this. Okay. When you outlaw that appeal of last resort, when you outlaw force as the appeal of last resort, and you replace it with words, words become weapons.
Absolutely. That's true.
Starting a religion without recognizing that is evil. Sorry, it just is. To make it so that your single combat is words is to destroy the human capacity for communication. Now, how does this relate to sortocracy? How does this relate to sorting proponents of social theories or other ways, sorting religious beliefs into territories that can pursue their beliefs? How is one not, in that situation, making words the appeal of last resort? And the answer is very simple. Central requirement of this religion is that there are no prisons. Anyone can vote with their feet and leave. This has consequences that are very serious. One of the consequences is you have to have borders that exclude very rigorously. Because if once somebody comes in, you can't keep them from leaving.
Right. Yeah.
The prison becomes the world outside of your community. If there are other communities, if there are other religious communities that are willing to accept some scoundrel, well, he can go there. What if there is no place that a scoundrel can go? Or maybe he's not a scoundrel. Maybe he just doesn't fit anywhere, right?
Right.
Where he can go is into what I've called state of nature. And I've got the rules governing a state of nature up at the Sortocracy website. That requires that an individual man accept a challenge to natural duel on penalty of death. If he doesn't accept, he can be killed. The natural duel has to have a characteristic where there's not a closed area, not a small area, but it has to be in touch with nature. In other words, you are embedded in nature and you're working with nature. Tools that you might have, weapons that you might have would be weapons or tools that you yourself as an individual could be trained to fabricate from nature by the age of reproduction, basically.
Mm-hmm.
No artifacts of the group selectionist environment are allowed into the state of nature, except for when people are exiled into it, they're permitted a 10-inch blade and 50 yards of strong or 50 feet of strong cordage and military fatigues. That's it. Nothing else comes in. And that permits them to defend themselves immediately when they go in. It also permits them to have a tool, a a knife that they could build with themselves if they were trained in how to smelt metal, which can be done, or you can actually build some kind of a refinery to produce your own metal and then forge your own sword, for example, by the age of 18, if you're in a proper culture. And you can also fabricate rope. Okay. But this is the appeal of last resort in dispute processing. The intermediate ones being built with your feet. But nowhere do words end up being the ultimate deciding factor.
As things stand right now, it's the situation you're describing would basically make it a liability to lie about people, right? There would be consequences to it as opposed to today, right?
Well, if you're talking about the state of nature, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, but also, you know, there are places it's like, well, if you're... It's like in politics, when you're engaged in what I call liberal democracies, tyranny of the majority limited only by a vague laundry list of selectively enforced human rights. Okay.
Right.
This is a sort of long way of describing this nightmare we're calling liberal democracy. It's actually worse than that because now we have tyranny of the minorities. Okay.
Yeah.
But in that environment, you know, you're voting on what how we're all going to live now. And this violates the individual agency. You have to make it so that the individual has somewhere to go. He doesn't have to put up with the vote. And that means what you're really doing with, if you want to talk about one man, one vote, or one person, one vote, what you're really doing is you're not allocating authority over social policy. What you're doing is you're allocating land. Okay. And the land allocations can be democratic in a sense, and there are ways of making it so that you try to make each individual have something like the old concept of an allodium associated with them that's inalienable, okay, just like the allodium was inalienable, so that they can bring their authority over territory with them wherever they go and with whatever religious sect or community or social theory they join. So people have somewhere to live in a human ecology that is inviolable, that can have a border that they enforce against people coming in,
mm-hmm.
because they can't keep those people from leaving if they commit a crime. Okay.
Right.
So you better be careful about who you let in. This replaces... So the whole idea of politics of exclusion being somehow evil, well, you have to counterbalance that with the idea that you don't have prisons anymore. And indeed, you don't even have capital punishment even anymore until you get into the state of nature. Now, the important thing to understand about the state of nature is that, you know, E.O. Wilson, again, has talked about biodiversity being reduced by human eusociality, which means when humans get together and form groups and hierarchies and have property rights and all the rest of these accoutrements that are permitted by positions of authority that are protected from, say, natural duel by some, you know, young buck, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have all these you know, gracious little things of civilization that come into being. You need some way of allocating the authority over those things so that, well, the individual male who wants to have a family needs to be able to do something to be able to recover from whatever theft of wealth he might have had to start a family. And that is, he goes someplace and he has land that he can sort of garden or his family or support his family with it. But he does so in conjunction with other people that share his beliefs in general. And he doesn't have to argue with anybody about it. He doesn't have to fight anybody about it. Okay, so you could get rid of war that way as well. You go into the state of nature, you also are allocating land to the state of nature, which can increase the nature preserves. By reducing the eusocial impact on the nature preserves, you're increasing biodiversity. You make it so that people can't suppress the diversity of life that E.O. Wilson talks about being suppressed by human civilization. He doesn't have an answer to it. In fact, at the end of the book, he talks about, he spends a lot of time in the book talking about the creation story, the true creation story of humans being based on science, etc. And at the end of the book, he starts talking about, well, I have now confessed my own blind faith in humanity's ability to control its appetite for resources and to preserve biodiversity, etc. Mm-hmm. And by the way, you know, don't go into space. That's not the answer, and, you know, etc. So he doesn't really have an answer either. But I think that I do. I think that by having this enforcement of an individual male challenging another individual male to natural duel, that one connects humans with nature in a profound way, but also it automatically does things like limit population. You are going to have starvation, perhaps. You're going to have people that are killing each other, but it's never going to be war. War is not permitted. What happens if anybody tries to, well, actually, under the rules, it's not permitted, because any kind of conspiracy or gang formation is immediately punishable by death. Okay. Just like there was an old Norse law that said groups of armed men running around the countryside were to be considered outlaws. And that was one of the things that I think Saint Olaf violated. Mm-hmm. Olaf the Lawbreaker, I think many, some people taught.
Right.
But that was one of the. So, in any event, you get automatic control of population through conflicts that are resolved between men. And there are going to be situations where people are going to starve or people are going to be killed. So there's a hard edge to this, but there's a hard edge to nature as well.
Yes, it is. Always.
And I have to, you know, reiterate this thing about individual perception of integrity, and especially in the male. I mean, the female, we recognize that a female's choice and desire for children is inviolable. To a violent equivalent of rape. That's one of the reasons that people object to arranged marriages in many cultures like Islam and Hindu, etc., in the West. But we do not yet recognize what we've done to males by restricting their individual judgment of who needs to be killed and bottling that up for times of war, when men are driven so insane by years and perhaps being dishonored by preachers or television or politicians and not being able to respond in a healthy, natural way.
That's right.
Then they're given an outlet in war to become sadists, or police become sadists.
Yeah.
And this is a horror that's committed against men. And it can be ameliorated to some extent, as did the LDS when they made the man, the father, the priest in the household, gave him authority in the household. And made formal recognition of this. Islam does this to an extent, as well, as which is one of the reasons why I believe that they're actually successful in the modern environment, because of the fact that they recognize that the foundation of civilization is this sacrifice of masculine authority that, if you aren't careful, will be viewed instinctively by females as somehow bringing the status of that man in their life down. And it's, I think that one of the things that happened with the sort of the hippies and the sexual revolution was we did restore to women their individual sovereignty, but we did not do so to men.
Yeah.
And there was, right. was so that was sexual perversion, feminism, homosexuality, the loss of respect of the men who built civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And there needs to be some way for people to form communities in which this is honored, the masculine sacrifice on behalf of civilization and its protections of women and the things that they want is honored. And you can only have that if you're permitted to exclude things like sexism is bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
You also have to recognize that when foreign males come into an environment, they are, in a natural environment, they're excluded normally by single combat. You look at the Y chromosome of all sexual species, and it's very geographically structured. Females, the mitochondrial DNA, female DNA, is very dispersed.
Yes, because it goes all over the place.
Yeah, young women are allowed to roam, and they're welcomed everywhere,
right?
Basically, more or less, unless they have children. Made, you know, sometimes if you look at some species, they'll kill off the children, you know, and that's harsh. And, you know, I'm not saying that's what you do, but it's the kind of thing where they might be excluded. They're not accorded as much natural welcome. So, trying to restore the respect for the sacrifice that men make of their individual sovereignty in founding civilization, so that positions of authority can be protected,
mm-hmm. Right?
Accumulations of wealth can be protected, is another thing that has to happen.
Let me ask you, we're going to take a break here in a little bit, but obviously I've tons of questions for you to kind of break this down more. You've outlined a lot of this, but so all of these are the components to the suggestions that you have made, right, to form this religion that you're talking about. Why call it a religion if it's just kind of a structure of government? Where's the spiritual? This is a long question, so maybe we have to deal with this in detail in the next segment, but the spiritual component on top of this is something that would make it a religion as opposed to just a governmental structure, right?
Right. Let me tie that back into my original religious experience. Okay. Part of my dissatisfaction and my with the world as it is, having experienced this, was tied up in the sense that I couldn't express. You know, there were too many things in the environment that were in conflict that I couldn't resolve properly. I couldn't address the conflicts properly. So it was continually a matter of compromise, and my integrity was, in a sense, compromised. And a man's integrity is really his essence. Let me put it another way, I guess. This moral impetus, I believe, is a direct descendant of the Creator. This individual perception of what I should do or what I should be is a direct descendant of the Creator. And people are going to say, well, you know, we know evolution, we know physics, evolution, blah, blah, blah. I'll say this to them very quickly, okay? It is known and proven mathematically that, say, a computer capable of performing any mathematical function, called a Turing machine, can emulate another Turing machine of a different design. Okay, if we see ourselves as intelligent and we see ourselves as computers, okay, we have to recognize that nothing less powerful than a Turing machine equivalent is able to emulate us. Therefore, the universe itself has to have as much capability as we ourselves have. Okay. On top of that, we have to confront the miraculous nature of our own existence.
Right.
Every one of us.
Yep.
And so when we do this subject-object dichotomy between the universe and our own consciousness and our own being, and on top of that, try to say that the universe is dumb and not creative. We are dumb.
That's right.
We're getting it.
Yep.
Okay. We are descendants of the Creator. And every decision, or we are in fact thoughts of the Creator. We have thoughts, but we are thoughts that have thoughts. Okay. As thoughts, we have integrity. A thought that doesn't have integrity is useless. It's only a thought that has integrity that can be sort of compared and contrasted with another thought. As thoughts, it's our job to have the greatest integrity that we can as in our being, as an expression of creation, the Creator's thoughts. So it's rooted in that sort of primordial experience of being part of creation, a thought in the mind of the Creator, and honoring it and sacralizing it,
and awareness of our existence and what we're part of, in other words, to a certain extent.
Right, and understanding that what we're really a part of isn't part of a government or a society, or we're a part of nature. We're a part of the creator. And, you know, this whole thing about civilization is like, you know, this is something we, you know, came up with just a few thousand years ago. And, you know, as sexual beings, which is one of the things we have to really recognize that it's been damaged in us, especially with masculine sacrifice for civilization, that's 600 million years old, if not older. You know, people say, well, you know, individuality, you know, individualism, well, that's this, you know, recent construct. It's like, boy, you don't get it. I have other things to say about what happened in the lineage of primates and humans and things like that in the next segment. But that's the answer to your question.
Very interesting, James. You know, very, very, there are many components to this that takes a long time to kind of break down and everything. I want to make sure that our audience too, as we begin the second segment here in a bit, get a chance to understand these components and also not just kind of throw it out the window because of the fact that it's like, oh, okay, it's just another kind of wacky church or a cult or something. And that's actually something I'm going to address in the beginning of the second segment and with many other things. But give us the website to Sortocracy, if there's any other sources or something that audience should check out so they can learn more about this.
Well, my problem is I can't set up the website for the religion because of the fact that I need to get everything registered legally, because there have been churches that didn't register the names, et cetera, and their symbols properly, and then they were shut down or profoundly damaged by their enemies. So I don't have the resources because of the fact that I've been coming out of this caregiving situation and I need to reenter the professions. So I do need support, my financial support, to get that done. But sortocracy.org is the place that has sort of the secularization of this, if you wish to call it an ecclesiastical kind of structure, that's fine. The moral impetus is what I've been talking about. It is a religious impetus behind this. So sortocracy.org, go click on the About link. There are a couple of audio segments that you should listen to as an introduction before reading the rest of it.
Very good. Now, are you inviting people at this stage? You mentioned you're writing something on this, etc. What's the plan with this? Is a book in the works, or how?
A book is in the works. I got the outline. It's, like I said, words are dangerous, and this is not sacred writing.
Right.
It's simply trying to lay some of the stuff out in a book form, and you know, the completion of that is going to be dependent upon the time that I have to devote to it.
Right.
And given other things I have to do.
All right. Is there any other way that you want to have people help you out in some way and get involved, or what would you say to that for people who are interested?
Well, I'd say they can contact me at my Gmail address, jabowery, Bowery, gmail.com. And maybe I can put up a Bitcoin address if they want to, you know, send a few $100 so I can get things registered with the government.
Okay, very good, James. We'll have the links up to that, of course. Then we'll proceed to talk more about this in the second. Looking forward to it. It's very interesting. Stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. Stay with us, James. We'll be right back after this break.
Trollet friade till fagerunger Sven, hon hade en falskeliger tunga. Är mannelig, troloven i mig, för det jag bjuder så gärna. I kunden väl svara endast ja eller nej, om i heder vill jag giva de gångare tolv som går ut i rosende lunde. Aldrig har det varit någon sadel upp på den, ej heller betsel ut i munnen. Är mannelig, trolov.
Well, as we return with the second hour, we discuss more of the proposals that James has and many of his ideas. He ties in the work of Edward O. Wilson, E. O. Wilson, who wrote The Social Conquest of Earth. We discuss our developments as Europeans as a eugenic one with individualism and how we, with the domestication of the dog, could become a pack leader, but still remain autonomous and an individual. And this, James proposed, led us in a different direction than many of the other groups and races. But an interesting development. He talks about womb wars, demographics, the Green Revolution, and the arguments that mass immigration and unchecked globalization and international capitalism is leading to the destruction of nature and our natural habitats. It's a very interesting second hour with a lot more of James' ideas, so definitely don't miss it. Go to redeyesmembers.com and subscribe to hear the rest of this and all our previous shows in full. A 3-month subscription is only 18 euros, 6 euros per month. Like nothing, it's peanuts. So definitely check it out. Over 1,000 shows. We also have videos, films, inside episodes, and also the live show, our Weekend Warrior shows now. We have Adrian Davis, a barrister from the UK, coming up on the show next. He is savvy on the rise of nationalism in Western Europe and will be talking about the Brexit aftermath. We also have Matt Forney coming on later at some point discussing his coverage of the Republican and Democratic National Conventions. Then this coming Saturday, July 9th, we'll be back with our 5th Weekend Warrior episode, live for members. Don't miss it. Talk to you after the break. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be right back.